From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Sitting in for Tony is today's host, Jody Heiss.
Well, good afternoon. It is Tuesday, October the 8th. Welcome to this edition of Washington Watch. I am your host, Jody Heiss, Senior Vice President at the Family Research Council and President of FRC Action. So glad to have you on board. Let me give you some of the highlights that we'll be discussing today. First of all, as we all know by now, the state of Florida is bracing for this week's arrival of Hurricane Milton, which certainly could be one of the most powerful and destructive hurricanes on record.
We have 51 counties currently under a state of emergency. As of the 5 a.m. advisory, Hurricane Milton is still a major hurricane. It is no longer a Category 5, but it potentially could strengthen back to that as it makes its approach to the state of Florida.
That, of course, was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis earlier today. And as we all await Hurricane Milton's landfall, the fact is the recovery effort from the destruction of Hurricane Helene continues throughout portions of the Southeast region. And Tennessee Congressman Tim Burchett will be joining me here in a few moments with an update from the Volunteer State. And yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court kicked off yet another term. This time they're going to be looking at some major upcoming cases involving everything from gender drugs and mutilation for children to workplace DEI discrimination, as well as Second Amendment rights. Josh Hammer, the senior counsel at the Article 3 Project, will be joining me a little bit later in the program to preview those cases and share what we can expect during the Supreme Court's 9-month term, now officially underway. And last Saturday in Pennsylvania, Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance shared what he and former President Trump think about government funding for Planned Parenthood and late-term abortions.
The question of defunding Planned Parenthood, look, I mean, our view is we don't think that taxpayers should fund late-term abortions. That has been a consistent view of the Trump campaign the first time around. It will remain a consistent view.
And I'll be talking about that with FRC's Mary Zock, who also has the details on a new FRC publication regarding the 10 states where abortion initiatives are on the ballot this November. And I can assure you, you want to hear about that resource. It could be extremely valuable going into this election. And speaking of the life issue, that was certainly one of many topics that were covered during last week's Pray Vote Stand Summit.
We're seeing medical information peddling false information, terrifying women, when the reality is that every state law, everyone, allows doctors to do whatever is necessary to save the life of a mother, and no state prevents treatment for miscarriages or ectopic pregnancies.
Well, that was Erin Hawley from ADF. She was countering the left's claim that pro-life laws are responsible for the death of a woman in Georgia. And trust me, that's not the only area where fear is being used to mislead. And Travis Weber, who's FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, he'll be joining me a little bit later in the program to talk about where else we're seeing fear used in this way. And he'll share some of his reflections on the summit as well. And by the way, if you missed the Pray Vote Stand Summit last week, I'm thrilled to tell you that it's not too late to catch the highlights. For more information and see how you can get caught up on what was indeed a powerful as well as an encouraging conference, you can go to tonyperkins.com and get more info. All right, so we've got a lot coming your way. Let's go ahead and jump into it. As recovery efforts following the devastating effects of Hurricane Helene continue throughout portions of the Southeast, the Biden-Harris administration is now drawing fire for the federal response to that disaster. In fact, just last week, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, he said that FEMA, which of course he oversees, may lack the funding that they need for this hurricane season. Meanwhile, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre insists that disaster relief funds come from a portion of FEMA's budget that is different from where the Biden-Harris administration spent a reported $1.4 billion on the border in recent years. So the obvious question that many are asking right now is this: is FEMA being mismanaged? It's a great question. And joining me now to help make sense of the situation is Congressman Tim Burchett. He serves on several committees, including the Foreign Affairs, the Oversight Committee, and Transportation. He is coming to us from the 2nd Congressional District of the great state of Tennessee. Congressman Burchett, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to have you, my friend.
Thank you, brother. It's always good to be here.
Okay. Boy, Tennessee, your home state, it was hit pretty hard. There's a lot of rumors of and accusations. There's of misinformation swirling around. Give us the latest. What's happening there in Tennessee?
Well, Upper East, pretty much the area that I represent, was not really hit that hard, heavy rains. Diane Harshberger's was hit, was devastated, actually. The big rains came out of 20 or 30 inches of rain in a short amount of time, came out of North Carolina. And, of course, it came through those hollers down through the mountain, and it just wiped those. It just, you know, increased in volume and just wiped those areas out. And, of course, the FEMA has not produced, really. They have a budget of $40 billion. You've seen they have $6 or $7 billion that they still have available for some sort of disaster relief that they haven't accessed, and yet the people of this area have received $4 million. I talked to a sheriff yesterday in one of the areas I don't represent, but he was very blunt in his explanation. He said, yeah, we heard from FEMA. He said, Tim, we heard from FEMA a few days back. They did some sort of survey, and we haven't seen them since. And that's sort of what you're seeing. Samaritan's Purse and all these other groups are up there on the ground. FEMA is still staying at some $300 a night motel if they're even in the area. And I think Governor DeSantis really is showing the way it's supposed to be done. You know, we ought to do the Department of Education. We ought to disband them and send that money to the states so they would know it's not a one size fits all. Let your like in Tennessee, our National Guard, 401 of them are on the ground up there. We ought to be up there with them with helicopters and providing the aid and taking care of people. But instead, you've got a bureaucracy out of Washington that is clearly clueless. And all they do is want more money. They rob from that to give to illegals. That money should have been for Americans. And, and then when Kamala Harris says she's going to have $750, you have people that have clearly been turned down. They have lost everything. A lady was offered $300. You know, it's a nightmare of what's going on. It just shows you how out of touch Washington, D.C. is with America.
It really is, and sad to say, and of course, you know, you only can connect dots from what you see, and perhaps some of those dots being connected are inaccurate, but there is a lot of appearance that much of this, at least, is politically driven, and, I mean, shameful if that is the case, but I want to get back to FEMA, but before I go there, let me just, the images coming out are heartbreaking. How would you best describe the situation to those of us who are not on the ground there?
Indescribable. I've heard a war zone after an atomic bomb has gone off. Yeah, just entire communities have disappeared. They're just rubble, and there's no other way to explain it. They're telling me it'll be 3 to 4 months before some of these people even have electricity or water, running water. And I think one thing we need to be clear. I loaded trucks this weekend with some folks. My buddy Jeremy Faison's a state rep up there, and he's been great. I talk to him every day about what's going on in his district and the devastation. But you really can't imagine the devastation. And the thing we got to remember is in 3 months or 4 months, nobody's going to be talking about Upper East Tennessee or North Carolina because the Florida hurricane's going to roll through there. And we got to make sure that these people are taken care of. They're conservative, God-fearing folks, Jody. They're just wonderful folks, and they're not sitting there with their hand out. They're trying to survive. People are living in tents beside creeks, to get their water, and we can do so much better for them.
And we need to thank God for organizations like Samaritan's Purse and many, many, many churches I've been reading about are going up and down streets and communities doing all they can. But that brings us back to the point of where is FEMA? I mean, talking points from the Biden-Harris administration is that FEMA's disaster relief funding comes from some sort of different funding bucket than the billion plus that they've spent on the border. But at the end of the day, it all comes from the taxpayers.
From our back pocket. You're exactly right. And our currently we add, as you know, $1 trillion to our debt load every 100 days. In 5 or 6 years, the number one thing we'll be paying is interest. And these economists say, oh, Tim, you don't understand. You don't understand how government works. No, the trouble is I do understand how government works, and they can't sell it. That's the problem we have. And, you know, I was at a luncheon today, and I was talking about some of my friends across the aisle who are Marxist left-wingers, and that actually believe that stuff. But what the people I was most angry with are the so-called Republicans that continue this reckless spending, these policies. You know, we passed a CR that the FEMA budget was in. But guess what? All that other garbage was, too. We ought to have single-item voting. We ought to vote on single items when we vote budgetary items. That's why everybody would have to get up and explain what their bill is and what it's for. No, we do a 3,000-page bill. We get, you know how it is. You had 3 hours to read it. It's full of garbage. And you look in there and people are calling you, oh, I need this special project or whatever. And that's where the crookedness takes over. There's billions of dollars in there for COVID relief. And COVID's over. But where does that money go? And I submit to you that there's billions of other dollars that are unaccounted for in programs that no longer exist, that just go down some black holes.
No question. All right, we've only got about a minute or so left. Congressman, you've no doubt you've seen communities come together caring for one another in spite of FEMA being horribly absent. Are you seeing the communities come together?
I am, more than you would ever believe. We had a little event this past weekend on Saturday, and 6 hours, our mayor here, Glenn Jacobs, helped put it on, and we all chipped in. And we were trying to fill up one tractor trailer load, and we filled three with food and drinks and clothing and things like that, things that are needed. And America turns out, you know, the South, especially East Tennessee, Tennesseans, it is the volunteer state. But I would ask people to continue to pray for these folks because they are just devastated. And I'll guarantee you FEMA will use them to try to get more money, and they will not see any of it. If they do, it'll be very limited.
Well, we do thank God for the American spirit that still exists. I know my former congressional district in Georgia had been just private citizens flying back and forth, taking as much supplies as they can. Thank you, Congressman Tim Burchett of Tennessee. We deeply appreciate all that you do for our country, and thank you for joining us yet again on Washington Watch. God bless you.
Pray for our country. Thank you, brother.
Absolutely. All right, after the break, we've got a lot more to deal with, including cases that are going to be coming before the U.S. Supreme Court as they begin a brand new term. Lots of stuff in there that they'll be looking at, as well as some things that they're not going to be looking at. All of it will bring your way right after the break, so don't go anywhere. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you a Christian parent looking to raise a spiritual champion in today's culture? Renowned author George Barna has written a new book, Raising Spiritual Champions. This book offers valuable insights based on extensive research conducted by George Barna, the Family Research Council, and Arizona Christian University. Learn how to help your children discern biblical truth and find compelling meaning and purpose. Don't miss out on this essential resource for parents. Order your copy today.
Hello, I'm Jody Heiss, president of FRC Action. Here in America, we thank God for the right to vote, and we can all agree on the importance of this upcoming election. Many of us want to support candidates who share our values, but we're not comfortable supporting the big national political organizations. Well, we have a solution for supporting candidates through FRC Action's Faith, Family, and Freedom Fund. Being a super PAC, It allows for unlimited individual and corporate donations, so we can endorse and fund campaigns for people who share our values. By giving to this fund, we're able to pull all of our contributions together and support and endorse like-minded candidates. That's how we move the needle. So let's be the best stewards possible and get the most out of our political contributions by uniting our efforts. For more information or to contribute, visit faithfamilyfreedomfund.org. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
All of us are born with the desire to find truth and meaning. Where did I come from? What happens when I die? While our answers to these questions may divide us, we are united in our need for the freedom to answer life's biggest questions and make life's biggest decisions for ourselves. That's why religious freedom matters for everyone. Religious freedom matters because the powerful have long wanted to control those who are less powerful. Religious freedom matters because the freedom of those who are different is often threatened by those who believe different is dangerous. At the Center for Religious Liberty at Family Research Council, we promote religious freedom for everyone because the only alternative is religious freedom for no one. We encourage Americans and the American government to engage and advocate for the persecuted, and they do. We work every day to bring good news to the afflicted, to proclaim liberty to captives and freedom to prisoners. We do it because that's what Jesus does. We work to give freedom to others because we ourselves have been set free.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Washington Watch. As always, thank you so much for joining us. I'm your host, Jody Heiss, an honor to be sitting in today, to be sitting in this week for Tony. All right, as each October rolls around, the U.S. Supreme Court also begins a new term. And this year, they're facing some very important cases. So what are some of those things that we're tracking, some of those issues that are on the Supreme Court's docket for this upcoming term? And how will those affect American families? Well, here now with his insights is Josh Hammer. He's a senior counsel at the Article III Project. Josh, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to have you.
Congressman, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with this. Before we start looking at some of the cases that the Supreme Court is going to be hearing, what are some of the cases that it declined, some of those things that probably some of us thought that they would take up? I'm thinking particularly of the Texas hospital case and the Alabama IVF case.
Yeah, you know, that Alabama IVF case got a lot of headlines back in February. I actually wrote my weekly syndicated column on that very topic back at the time. But what was lost in the weeds was that while this is obviously a politically and in some ways morally fraught issue, IVF, that particular case was actually a very straightforward case of statutory interpretation. So essentially, just real quick, what had happened then, the Alabama Supreme Court and the Alabama State Judiciary had uninterrupted interpreted its wrongful death of a minor statute for a very long time to hold that when the statute talks about child and children, then unborn child and unborn children are included there. So all the court had to do was to not legislate from the bench and to read in an extra utero exception whereby the legislature had not done that. Now, the Alabama legislature actually subsequently then added that in, Jody, but it's not surprising to me that Congress actually did not, or excuse me, that it's not surprising that the Supreme Court did not step in there, given the fact that legally speaking was actually a fairly straightforward case. But I understand that a lot of people are probably surprised as to why they do that. It's just a reminder that the court doesn't necessarily step in every time there is a politically or morally charged issue. Rather, they only do so when there are very clear conflicts of interpretation and that there is a legally interesting case at hand.
Okay, interesting. Good insight there. Okay, so moving on to the cases that the Supreme Court has decided to take up, a case involving gender mutilation procedures on children, I think all of us anticipated this. I mean, that one was destined to get at the Supreme Court eventually anyways. Many people are going to be tracking the case concerning Tennessee's law protecting minors from transgender mutilation surgeries. Tell us about this one. What do you anticipate?
This is definitely the money case from my perch, from where I sit. This is probably the single biggest case of this term, the same way that the Dobbs abortion case was the biggest case in the term ending in 2022, and then the affirmative action case was the biggest term of the term ending in 2023. So the transgender so-called gender affirming care case, this is definitely the marquee case. So it does come out of Tennessee. They have an exceptional attorney general there, Jonathan Scrimeti. And the Sixth Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, ruled the correct way in ultimately upholding Tennessee's ability to regulate, if not outright ban, if they want, genital mutilation for children. Now, the other side is making a 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause argument. They're essentially arguing that transgender status, that gender identity, is a constitutionally protected suspect class under the 14th Amendment, the same way that the Supreme Court has in the past held that various other classifications along racial or sexual lines get you either strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny. So they're basically saying that this gets heightened scrutiny and legalese, and therefore a state cannot regulate it unless there is a truly, truly, truly compelling interest. I, as you and I know, and as anyone with any common sense knows, you really don't have to be a lawyer to know that this is total bumpkin. That's not how it works, because in reality, for thousands and thousands of thousands of years, we have always known that there are two sexes in humanity. There is male and there is female. We know that from natural observation. We know that from just empirically observing the way the world works. We know it from Genesis 1:27 as well. We know that every which way we can know it. And Tennessee is well within its rights to regulate, and if it wants to outright ban genital mutilation and chemical castrations for minors, that it can do so. I'm actually fairly confident that the Supreme Court is going to do the right thing here. I never want to get too ahead of my skis, but as far as constitutional law goes, I think it's a fairly, fairly straightforward case. I'm optimistic about this one.
Well, let's certainly hope so. Another case is Texas age verification law for websites with sexually explicit content. What precedent do you think we could see there, maybe?
So I'm optimistic about this one, too, but maybe not quite as optimistic as the other one. You know, it's funny. I typically am pessimistic about the court, so I'm kind of surprising myself when I say that I'm so optimistic about some of these culturally and morally charged cases there. But historically speaking, I mean, this is kind of just federalism, constitutional law 101. And of course, Jody, you serve in Congress, so I'm preaching to the choir here. But the Congress has specifically enumerated powers under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. There are 18 clauses there. So they have the power when it comes to militia and raising money and various other things. And the traditional view is that the police powers reside in the 50 states. And the traditional way that the police powers were viewed was to regulate the health, morals, and safeties of their respective populations. Those are really the three big legs of the three-headed state police power stool, you might say. I cannot think of something that more quintessentially fits the state police power, if we even still believe in something like a state police power in the 21st century. But if we believe in it at all, surely it's going to apply to the ability of Texas to implement an age verification for pornographic websites. Now, the Supreme Court case law on the issue of pornographic websites is kind of hit or miss. So there was the ACLU versus Reno case from the late 1990s, which is a ruling that redounded, unfortunately, far too much to the interests of the pornography industry. But I think that this current court stands in a good position, or as good a position as any, to start to slightly pare back the ACLU versus Reno ruling and to side with Ken Paxton in Texas.
Well, it's going to be interesting to me how they decide on this, and then you weigh that up against the pornographic books in libraries and schools that are being used for children. This has to enter into the long-term debate on all of this. So very, very interesting how all of these cases. I wish we had time to get into some more. But thank you so much, Josh Hammer. Always great to have you giving us your insight and great work that you and everyone there at Article 3 Project do. Thank you for joining us today.
I really appreciate it, Congressman. Thank you.
You bet. All right, friends, our commitment bringing you all the latest. It's amazing. All right, we've got much more coming your way right after the break. We're going to be looking at some of the highlights from the Pray Vote Stand Summit. FRC's Travis Weber is going to be joining me, and we encourage you to stay tuned. Great stuff coming straight ahead.
Everything we do begins as an idea. Before there can be acts of courage, there must be the belief that some things are worth sacrificing for. Before there can be marriage, there is the idea that man should not be alone. Before there was freedom, there was the idea that individuals are created equal. It's true that all ideas have consequences, but we're less aware that all consequences are the fruit of ideas. Before there was murder, there was hate. Before there was a Holocaust, there was the belief by some people that other people are undesirable. Our beliefs determine our behavior, and our beliefs about life's biggest questions determine our worldview. Where did I come from? Who decides what is right and wrong? What happens when I die? Our answers to these questions explain why people see the world so differently. Debates about abortion are really disagreements about where life gets its value. Debates over sexuality and gender and marriage are really disagreements about whether the rules are made by us or for us. What we think of as political debates are often much more than that. They're disagreements about the purpose of our lives and the source of truth. As Christians, our goal must be to think biblically about everything. Our goal is to help you see beyond red and blue, left and right, to see the battle of ideas at the root of it all. Our goal is to equip Christians with a biblical worldview and help them advance and defend the faith in their families, communities, and the public square. Cultural renewal doesn't begin with campaigns and elections. It begins with individuals turning from lies to truth. But that won't happen if people can't recognize a lie and don't believe truth exists. We want to help you see the spiritual war behind the political war, the truth claims behind the press release, and the forest from the trees.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Jody Heiss, sitting in this week for Tony. Glad to have you with us. All right. Many of us here at the Family Research Council are, frankly, still on a high from last week's Pray, Vote, Stand Summit. We're exhausted, but we're still on a high. And when you look at the monumental election that's approaching, combined with a world that's in crisis, when you have a summit like this that provided so much hope, so much encouragement, as we're all in the midst of this critical season, it was just absolutely fantastic. And joining me now with his reflections is Travis Weber. Travis is Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs here at FRC. Travis, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to have you.
Jody, thank you. It's good to be with you.
All right. Well, I know that you also found the Pray, Vote, Stand Summit to be certainly educational, but it was also filled with incredible spiritual nourishment. Share with our audience a little bit of your thoughts on the event as a whole.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the event was very encouraging. Obviously, we're dealing with difficult, weighty topics. The topics, if we look at them too long, they can really weigh us down. They can get us down in the dumps. But that's why we have to look to the Lord Jesus and the Word of God, and to remember that God has everything in His hands, God has everything in control, and God will equip us, empower us, and guide us to walk through how to navigate these difficult topics. So, Jody, it's very important to be dealing with, as we deal with the topics we are dealing with, to do so in the context of Christian fellowship and encouragement of other believers. And I really think that came out at the summit this year, not only in what was shared from the stage, but in the conversations, the time together with other attendees offstage, between speakers and attendees offstage. So it really was an encouraging time.
It really was. And, you know, there are so many uplifting words that were delivered during the conference. I mean, my mind just goes back on several while we're here even talking. But all of them were really within the context of the challenges that we're seeing across our country and across the world. And one of those challenges is how fear is literally being used to mislead so many, both here in the U.S. as well as globally. But you were on one of those panels that specifically discussed global governance and the World Health Organization. I wanted Travis to play a clip from that panel and then get your thoughts. If we could please play clip two.
I think as we've been watching this play out over the last decade, really, and you start to see the way that global governance is designed to essentially use words like cooperation to mean control. So, and it's always propaganda. It's always using health scares. It's using some sort of emergency that they can declare so that you have fear, so that you then fall into a psychological, essentially totalitarian mindset to want to obey the orders. And so some leader will tell you what to do, so it removes your anxiety.
Wow, powerful thought. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, Jody, I think Gabe Lyons is exactly right. He's pointing out a trend that we need to be aware of. Christians need to be aware of these days in our nations, in how individual governments approach the certain matters, but how they're also being approached globally. So this was a global government panel. But the interesting thing was, as we were focusing on what is happening globally, the remedy is to be found locally. And so one of the ways in which we can deal with an increasingly world in which we're not sure what to make of certain information that may come across our plate or in that we're being fed, is to go to the communities around us, make sure we have trusted networks of others in our communities we're relying on, we're in community with, and we're in human relationship with, in a world in which increasingly humans are relating to machines and smartphones. So Gabe Lyons identifies the problem, but he also helps people walk through it in the right way. He's not approaching it in a fearful manner. He's just saying, let's identify this clear-eyed, in a clear-eyed way, and say, well, how should we navigate it, right? So these are, he's addressing a serious area, but he's also showing people how to walk into it.
And I think that's so important, and I agree. I think the overall tone of the conference produced that. I mean, people, I know many that I spoke with personally took some of these thoughts that in a very personal way, but the encouragement that each was feeding on one another along with the panelists and the speakers was just incredible. So anything else that stood out to you that was just incredibly encouraging overall?
Yeah, Jody, you know, I think it's encouraging to be looking at the issues and the serious things we're facing in our world today with others who are coming before God. We're all together saying, Lord, we need your help to understand and to approach these things. And that was the real encouragement to me during the conference. You know, certainly today, look, we just passed the one-year anniversary of the attack on Israel. There was an Israel panel discussion at the conference, very significant, that to be discussing and praying about these things, praying for God's, for the Jewish people, who God has still has his eye on. He's not forgotten them. Christians need to be praying for the Jewish people and for their homeland, Israel, around the world. And so we were doing that. We were addressing what's happening, helping believers navigate it. Jody, you know, we had a panel, Understanding the Times. We need to understand the times we're in. You already referenced the WHO Global Issues panel I was on. You know, on that panel, we discussed things like the Digital Global Compact. Gabe Lyons referenced that, other global efforts in which global bodies are saying we want to tackle misinformation without much regard for free speech. So these are things we need to be aware of, not fearful, but praying, Lord, help us navigate them well.
The 2024 Pray Vote Stand Summit. Thank you, Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs here at FRC. All right, friends, after the break, we've got much more to come about the life issue and how it's going to be on the ballot. There's probably a lot more ways than you realize. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Jesus said in John 15, "These things I've spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you and that your joy may be full." In 2024, in these divided and uncertain times, how can this be possible? By abiding in him through his word. At Family Research Council, we want to help you do that, which is the reason for the Stand on the Word Bible reading plan. In just 10 to 15 minutes each day, you will have read the entire Bible in just 2 years. But more importantly, you will be abiding in him daily. Find our Bible reading plan at frc.org/Bible. And join Tony Perkins each weekday for a 10-minute devotional inspired by the daily reading and designed to encourage you on this journey through the Bible. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And remember, The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever.
The world is hurting. Streets are filled with crime. Families are broken. Sin is celebrated and God is mocked. Everywhere we look, the wages of our sin are on full display. As Christians, we know that surrender to God's will is the solution to our biggest problems, but not everyone agrees. Even in church, we hear people say the most important thing is to be tolerant, that we shouldn't impose a morality on other people, and that loving our neighbor means celebrating what they do. But you can't do that. It's not that you don't love your neighbor, you do. But you care about God's opinion more than your neighbor's opinion, and this makes you different. In fact, sometimes it makes you feel alone, like you're the only one. But there is good news. You are not alone, not even close. Research has found that there are 59 million American adults who are a lot like you. There are millions of people around the country who are born again, deeply committed to practicing their faith, and believe the Bible is the reliable word of God. But that's not all. They're also engaged in our government. They're voters. They're more likely to be involved in their community, and they're making a difference in elections. The problem is that a lot of them feel alone too. We want to change that. FRC wants to connect these 59 million Americans to speak the truth together, no matter the cost. If you want to learn more about this group and what it means to be a spiritually active, governance-engaged conservative, or if you want to find out if you are one of these SageCons yourself, go to frc.org/SageCon and take the quiz to find out. The world is hurting, and we have the solution. We can't do it alone, but we can do it if we work together. That's what we're working toward every day. Join us. Go to frc.org/SageCon, SageCon, to learn more. That's SageCon, SageCon, to learn more.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Honored to have you on board with us today. I'm your host, Jody High, sitting in this week for Tony. All right, we're just less than a month away from the 2024 election. And I know I don't have to remind you this, but America needs our prayers, all of our prayers. So we're asking you to join FRC in praying for a spiritual awakening in our nation as we come into this election cycle. And we have a free 40-day election prayer guide. It's all yours. All you need to do is text the word PRAY to 67742. Again, that's text the word PRAY to 67742 and get your election prayer guide today. All right, in talking to the press following a campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, that occurred over the weekend, Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance told reporters where he and former President Trump are when it comes to government funding for Planned Parenthood. And like other statements we've heard from the Trump-Vance campaign, the focus was on late-term abortion.
The question of defunding Planned Parenthood, look, I mean, our view is we don't think that taxpayers should fund late-term abortions. That has been a consistent view of the Trump campaign the first time around. It will remain a consistent view.
Well, that's great to hear. But a question comes up, is it only late-term abortions that we shouldn't be funding? Well, joining me now to discuss this is Mary Zock. She's the director for the Center of Human Dignity here at FRC. Mary, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Jody.
Okay, so give me your reaction to these recent comments from Senator Vance. Is it enough?
Well, I was thrilled by what Senator Vance said here. When we talk about late-term abortion, for the majority of Americans, we bring to light the reality of what an abortion is and what it does. Americans are not comfortable with the idea of a woman in months 7, 8, 9 going to an abortion business and having the abortionist there end the life of her child, who is likely able to survive outside the womb with assistance at that point. And so when we talk about late-term abortion, we bring that thought to people's minds. And the hope there is that they will eventually connect that baby at month 7 is the same exact baby that he was in month five, in month three, and right at the moment of fertilization. And so what I think the Trump-Vance administration, hopeful administration, would do to defund Planned Parenthood and say, hey, no funding of late-term abortions, really, I'm hopeful that that means they're committed to defunding Planned Parenthood completely.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Mary. It's the same baby at month eight, just for example, as it is in five. So, I mean, as much as I'm grateful for their commitment to stand opposed to late-term abortions, the issue goes beyond just the late term. You know, so many of us who have been involved in the pro-life movement, I mean, we know how barbaric Planned Parenthood is, probably for at least 10 years or so now. There's been so much evidence that have come forth, but some of our listeners, viewers may not be aware. Explain, if you would, Mary, some of the just what this organization does, Planned Parenthood.
Well, since 2015, we have known that Planned Parenthood is profiting off the sale of unborn babies' body parts. And that was exposed by David DeLeiden. And we know that Vice President Kamala Harris tried to shut down his attempt to bring this to light, and that she has gone after him because of what he has shown Planned Parenthood does. This is a horrific organization that profits off the death of unborn babies, off killing unborn babies. They market themselves as an organization that does mammograms and, you know, whatever other screenings. But in reality, what they are doing is killing unborn babies. Their number of breast cancer screenings has decreased by 81% since 1999. 81%. That's not an organization that's focused on the healthcare of Americans. That's an organization that's focused on its wallet. They've also increased recently their efforts to focus on transgender hormones for people who have gender dysphoria. And this, again, is an effort to focus on their pocketbooks, not on what's best for the American people, or not on what healthcare actually is, because Planned Parenthood does not do healthcare.
Yeah, great point. That's information that the public needs to be more aware of. I recall dealing with a lot of this during my time in Congress and was stunned year after year of the massive amount of money that Planned Parenthood receives. It comes from federal tax dollars. They're reimbursed for, you know, using Medicaid and federal grant dollars, that type of stuff. But polls after poll after poll shows that the majority of Americans oppose public funding for abortion. Even many of those who are in the pro-life side of things don't believe tax dollars should go to the practice of abortion. So is this one of those kind of issues that the abortion industry, frankly, just tries to quietly keep under wraps for their own profitability? Is that what's going on here?
I think they do. And they say, well, taxpayer dollars don't go directly toward abortion. Well, money's fungible. So if I give you $1.50 and tell you to spend it on one thing, you can use your other $1.50 on that one thing and spend my dollar on whatever you want. What Planned Parenthood is doing is they're taking advantage of American taxpayer dollars. They're receiving almost $700 million in taxpayer funds per year. And that's per their annual report. So that's their statistic that's telling us that. And on top of that, they're receiving $997 million in donor funds. So not only should American dollars not be funding Planned Parenthood because they engage in killing unborn children and then selling their body parts, but they don't need American taxpayer dollars. And in fact, those dollars would be much better spent actually helping people who need help.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Do you have any sense that the American voters, American taxpayers, have any degree of real understanding the extent to which their tax dollars are being used to subsidize the abortion industry? I feel as though they don't. I don't think the American public gets it. Do you have any sense on that?
I don't think that they do either. The majority of Americans, as you have said, don't want their taxpayer dollars funding abortion. Planned Parenthood says every time someone brings out that they receive taxpayer funds, they say, well, the Hyde Amendment protects taxpayer dollars from funding abortions, which it does. But again, money is fungible. And Democrats, including the Biden-Harris administration, have tried to get rid of the Hyde Amendment at every chance that they have gotten. So this idea that it's not happening, that our money is not actually funding the killing of unborn children and the selling of their body parts, is absurd.
I know in response to Senator Vance's comments from the other day, Jenny Lawson, who is the executive director of Planned Parenthood's Super PAC, she told the Washington Post that federal funds cannot be used to provide abortion care at any point of pregnancy. All right, so let's go back to what you were talking about a moment ago. Here we have a continual pushback on that issue from Planned Parenthood. None of the money is going to abortion. How truthful is Jenny Lawson when she makes this kind of statement?
Well, I think when Planned Parenthood is planning their budget, they plan that budget including the $700 million, or approximately $700 million, that they're going to receive from American taxpayers. And so that means that they can perform more abortions in more states. If we had seen over the last 25 years, if we had seen a huge increase in the number of mammograms that they're performing, or the amount of prenatal care that they do, they would maybe have a leg to stand on here. But in reality, these services have simply decreased. They have plummeted, actually. And the only things that have expanded are the number of abortions they do, which at this point are over 1,000 abortions a day. Over 1,000 unborn babies every day are killed by Planned Parenthood. And the gender transitions that they do, where now 45 of their 49 affiliates offer gender transition hormone therapy. So the idea that they're not using that American taxpayer dollars to expand their business is ridiculous.
Yeah, and when you talk about the so-called health care that they claim to provide, I mean, really, it looks like the new care, if we dare refer to it that way, that they're providing is what you just mentioned, the gender care, which is not gender care at all, but that seems to be a new arena that they are entering into with a great deal of aggression, isn't it?
It is, and that's a real moneymaker for them, because if you think about it, when someone has an abortion, Planned Parenthood, of course, is hoping that they'll be a repeat customer and that they'll have multiple abortions, but with gender hormone therapy, Planned Parenthood knows that this is a repeat customer. They know that this is someone who has to continue coming in regularly to receive the hormones. And so they've really struck a moneymaker here. And you can be sure that they will exploit the American people for everything that they're worth.
Wow. It's been said 1,000 times, but yet again, follow the money trail and you'll see it. If I can, Mary, shift gears with you real quickly. Probably a lot of voters, maybe a lot of our listeners, viewers right now may not be aware, but the life issue is majorly on the ballot in this upcoming election. At least 10 states are going to be voting on ballot initiatives regarding abortion. Can you give us the latest on that, what we're looking at going into this election?
Sure. As you said, Jody, there are 10 states where life is on the ballot, and with the exception of South Dakota, in every one of these states, the effort is to enshrine abortion through 9 months in the state constitution and get rid of every single law protecting unborn children that state previously had on the books. In South Dakota, the effort is also to enshrine abortion through 9 months, but some of the language there would allow some of the safety regulations to perhaps stay in place until, of course, the abortion industry goes back and challenges those. But what we're seeing in states like Missouri, states like Florida, states like New York, Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, these are states where there is an effort to say that there is a fundamental right to abortion to reproductive freedom. That's the language that they use here in Maryland, that there's a fundamental right to reproductive freedom, or that the abortion, not allowing, having any law that protects an unborn child is some form of discrimination, which is the language that we see in New York. And so these efforts would actually repeal any protections that the states have. And that includes parental consent laws. In some states, that includes parental notification laws. It includes protections for minors. It includes protections that prevent a sex trafficker from bringing in a minor to force them to have an abortion. So these are horrific ballot measures. And we need to get out and vote. We need to show up and stand up for the unborn.
Absolutely. And I'm really glad that you brought all that up, because FRC, Family Research Council, actually has published a new document. It's called Life on the Ballot, which does what you were just talking about. It explains the language on each of these ballot measures and the impact that each of these measures would have. Can you explain why this is a resource that really is desperately needed right now before we go into this election?
Well, the language of each of these ballot initiatives is a little bit different, and it's a little bit confusing. There are people who know a lot about protecting the unborn who read these ballot initiatives and wonder, like, gosh, what does that even do? And so what FRC attempted to do in this resource is to break down that language to tell people what these ballot initiatives would actually do, and to rely on the history. So far, we have lost every ballot initiative on life in previous elections. We haven't been able to withstand the onslaught of funding from outsiders, from George Soros, from everyone on the left that is working as hard as they possibly can to enshrine abortion into state constitutions. This ballot initiative resource is an effort to combat that, to say what this actually does, and to tear apart some of the lies that the abortion industry says. There's not a state in this country where a procedure done to protect a mother's life is illegal. There's not a single state where that is illegal. And that's a lie that the abortion industry keeps pushing, and that they're pushing with each of these ballot initiatives. So hopefully Absolutely. Our resource will be able to help combat some of them.
Absolutely. So where can people go real quickly to get this resource? I think it's extremely important for people to get and pass around. Where can they grab it?
It's available at frcaction.org.
All right. frcaction.org/life on the ballot. Mary Zock, thank you so much. Director of the Center for Human Dignity at FRC. Tremendous information you brought our way, as always, and we deeply appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Jody.
All right, friends, we've got a lot of work to do between now and Election Day coming up, and right there is one powerful resource that needs to be at your hands. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of Washington Watch. That wraps it up. Hope you have a fantastic remainder of your day, and we'll see you tomorrow right here on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.